Programming on Minnesota Public Radio, supported by the Walker Art Center's exhibition, Herzog and de Meuron, In Process, a look at the work of the Swiss architectural firm selected to design the Walker's expansion. Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Is it an election yet? Well, it depends on who you ask. Unofficial tallies from the Associated Press show Governor George W. Bush maintaining a slim lead of 327 votes in the all-important Florida recount. But state officials warn the official count won't be available until next week. Advisors for Vice President Al Gore's campaign have said the election isn't over for them. Mix in the legal challenges already filed in Florida, the mess over the ballot in Palm Beach County there, the rumors of recounts in at least three other states, and you have to wonder, when will this election be over? Well, we'll try to give you some answers this morning, and we're going to start our conversation with Mike Macinter. He's a professor of law at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He's the chair there of the legal panel of the Florida chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. A little later, we'll also be talking to David Yaloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut, where he studies constitutional law. We're going to start, however, with Professor Macinter. Hey, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Now, let's recap where we are now. The Associated Press is giving us unofficial results of the complete Florida recount. They say that Bush leads by 327 votes. But the official count can't come until maybe the end of next week. What's holding that up?
Two things hold up the official count in Florida. First, and less controversially, we allow people who are overseas to vote by absentee ballot and require only that they mail their absentee ballot postmarked in the country of origin on election day and that it be received in Florida within the following 7 days. So those ballots can still be in transit by mail from foreign countries, and when they arrive here, they'll be part of the official count. The second reason why nothing can be certified before Tuesday is that in some of the counties, we are going to have a hand recount of the ballots, and that will take place over the weekend. And in at least one county, court proceedings have blocked the county from certifying the final total until a court hearing.
All
that,
right.
Of course, is Palm Beach County.
I was just going to say, let's take these one at a time. What's a hand recount? Who wants it, and where is it taking place?
Okay, the hand recount is literally a human hand count of all of the ballot cards. We vote by punch cards in Florida, and in order to vote in Florida, one must insert the punch card into the ballot box and then push a metal device through the card, supposedly detaching from the card a small round piece of cardboard, which then makes it possible for the machine that reads the cards to read your vote. One of the purposes of the hand recount is to look individually at ballots in which that little circle, referred to by election professionals as a hanging chad, did not fully detach from the ballot and therefore was not counted by the machine, but may nevertheless reflect the intent of a voter to have voted for that candidate. And so those can be examined on a one-by-one basis. And then literally as they're being examined, that little piece of paper can fall off, removing any in uncertainty as to whether that's a countable ballot, and it would then be counted. So that's why the totals for everybody go up during the recount. Some of those so-called hanging chads just fall off the second time the ballot is counted, and it counts the second time even though it didn't count the first time.
What about those who argue that when you do a hand count, you are entering the human factor, which some, especially Republicans in this case, have said leads us down a slippery slope, that it could lead to even more error or irregularity, if you will?
Well, of course, this is a human process from the very beginning. Human beings designed the ballot not so well in Florida. Human beings designed the system of mechanical voting that we use, which is quite outdated already. And as far as the opportunity for chicanery in the hand recount, you can be certain that there will be several people from each party present at all times during that, monitoring it with the degree of precision we generally reserve for control of nuclear weapons.
Now, you mentioned the hand recount. You also mentioned court proceedings. What court proceedings are delaying the official tally?
There is a lawsuit already pending in Palm Beach County in state court, which is the proper court in which these proceedings should be taking place, because the claim there is that the use of the ballot in Palm Beach County that was designed by the local official violates Florida election law, and therefore that the vote in Palm Beach County does not, in fact, reflect the intent of the voters of Palm Beach County.
Are there other court proceedings that could delay this tally?
There will be other court proceedings, I'm sure of that, but at the end of the day, in each county, there will be one that will be decisive, and the likelihood of court proceedings outside of Palm Beach County is harder to assess. There have been scattered complaints of issues of racial intimidation from the northern part of the state, and those could end up in federal court because they involve questions under the Voting Rights Act. I have not seen much evidence to substantiate those claims yet, but then I don't live in that part of the state, so it's entirely possible that that evidence exists.
How likely are courts to intervene?
Courts are not likely to intervene in these sorts of things. Florida law gives a court substantial authority, actually, to intervene, but balanced against that, you have the historic practice that courts don't like to intervene in elections. To persuade a judge to set aside the result of an election in Florida, a lawyer or the litigants have to establish three things. They have to establish substantial noncompliance with the statutory election procedures. Here the argument is that the form of the ballot, the so-called butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County, violates two provisions of Florida election law. Secondly, the court has to make a factual determination that there is reasonable doubt as to whether the election expressed the will of the voters. And if the court is able to make that determination, then the court, according to the Supreme Court of Florida, and I quote, is to void the contested election even in the absence of fraud or intentional wrongdoing. So the focus of the litigation up there is going to be on the two questions of whether this particular form of the ballot actually does violate Florida election law, and then whether, as a consequence of that, the outcome of the vote did not, in fact, express the will of the voters.
You know, I read in the Associated Press that there's a large body of law in Florida on elections, and that the legal standard there is reasonable doubt, which isn't necessarily the highest threshold.
That's right. The standard the court uses is a factual determination that reasonable doubt exists as to whether a certified election expresses the will of the voters. Again, I'm quoting from the Florida Supreme Court. So that's the precise language the courts here use. But proof that reasonable doubt exists is a difficult standard to meet, even though it may not sound like a difficult standard. This is very different from showing reasonable doubt in a criminal case. In this kind of case, it's the people seeking to challenge the election who have to prove reasonable doubt. There's no presumption of reasonable doubt. There's a strong presumption of regularity in electoral outcomes.
Now, Mike Macenter, before we let you go, tell us what you think we're going to see in Florida over the next week or so.
Well, I think you're going to see lots of smoke and very little light over the next week in Florida as claims and counterclaims are made. But I really suspect that at the end of the day, this is a dispute that will be resolved by voters, not by courts, that once there has been a full and complete recount, including a hand recount in the challenged counties, that those totals are going to be the totals that stand. I would be very surprised if any court were to order a new election. That's just an extraordinary remedy in circumstances like this.
Mike Macenter, I want to thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mike Macenter is a professor of law at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He's also the chair there of the legal panel, the Florida chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. He joined us by phone. We're going to turn now to David Yaloff. He is a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut, where he teaches constitutional law. David Yaloff, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good to be here.
Oh, now, any reaction to what you just heard from Professor Macenter?
No, I thought it was a very clear and well-stated summary of where we are with all the legal actions that are going on in Florida today. I think, obviously, there are several laws in question, several Florida statutes, with some that apply to voting machine ballots, some apply to only those counties in which voting machines are not being used, and lawyers will have a field day trying to argue which of the statutes apply to these particular ballots and such, as they often do. But I thought it was a very, very eloquent summary of where we are right now, and I think his conclusions are quite apt.
What is your reaction to Vice President Al Gore's campaign vow to back a court fight over
these a lot of comparisons are being made between Al Gore's situation and Richard Nixon's dilemma, if you want to call it that, from 1960, and I'm not really sure those situations are analogous at all. The first place to start is I'm not really sure this is simply about Al Gore looking into his heart and looking into his soul and deciding what's right and not. There are many, many people who have invested lots of time, lots of resources, lots of their own personal time and effort into getting Al Gore elected. There is a party's hopes on the line. There are the future composition of the federal judiciary, of the U.S. Supreme Court, is riding on this decision. And simply for Al Gore to back out for the good of the country or because it's the manly thing to do, as I've actually seen some call it, it's not that simple. At this point, it's a very easy position for Al Gore to take, which is we're still counting, we're still recounting, there's going to be hand counting. We don't have any certification. We've got absentee ballots left. And so the position of your previous caller is, I think, exactly right. We have a lot more ways to go in terms of just determining what the people of Florida did. At the point where that is exhausted and now it moves into the courts, that's when you're going to see the real pressure fall on Al Gore and on top Democrats on what exactly he's willing to do to keep this going, assuming the votes hold in Florida.
But what about those who argue the presidency of the United States shouldn't be decided by a lone judge?
Well, it's a wonderful point, and I think the thing to keep in mind is it can't be. If this lone judge decertifies the Florida election or decertifies a portion of the Florida election such that the electoral votes are not going to be counted temporarily, there are several ways this could go. There actually is a provision of Florida state law that gives the state legislature the power to appoint electors if they're not appointed on election day. That's an issue of federal law. And so when you consider that, you have to compare that also to another provision which seems to make conclusive any determination of a voting controversy settled by means that the legislature has enacted prior to Election Day. We have two competing provisions. There's a small possibility that the Florida legislature could stand up and say, we're going to determine what these electoral votes are and who they go to. And no one knows how they would go with that, although I believe the composition leans Republican. And then there's one last point, Catherine, which is that in the event that there just are no electoral votes coming out of Florida, which a lot of people see as a small possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, the Electoral College will still meet. And while there's some debate, the words of the 12th Amendment state quite clearly that the president will be the one whose electoral votes number a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. Right now, Al Gore has 260 and George Bush has 246. That total right there is a overall number of which Al Gore has a majority. So there's just so many different variables in play here. It's just, to me, not possible that one local judge will determine it right there and then. He may or she may set off a chain of events that lead to another group, whether it's the House or the Electoral College, making that decision.
We're talking to David Yeloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. He also studies and teaches constitutional law. We're talking to him about this historic and amazing presidential election. Is it over yet? You tell us. 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Sashir in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes, hello. I ended up voting for Gore, but I think probably pending at the end of this recount, he should concede graciously and not make a legalistic challenge. I say that because it's probably the best thing for him, not just on a personal level, but also probably the best thing for the party. I think if Gore does win by sort of legalistic means through court challenges, I think he'll pretty much erode any sort of goodwill he's built up by winning the popular vote, albeit very slimly. And also it'll just cause Republicans to just really retrench pretty hard in Congress and not let him get anything passed. On the other hand, if he concedes graciously, I think things will sort of flip around and you'll find a big surge of popular will against George Bush, and you'll really have a hard time getting anything passed through a pretty active Democratic Congress, even though they are in the minority, though, again, very slimly. And it will really encourage a lot of crossover votes from Republicans in the Congress, probably leading to the Democrats taking back Congress in 2002. And if you look at the history of where there's been a split in the popular vote in the Electoral College, in two out of three cases, the, quote, loser of the election came back and won in the following election cycle. And you can say in the case of Richard Nixon, who decided not to challenge the vote in 1960, he still managed to come back and win in 1968. So, again, it's kind of an odd thing the way I look at it at this point is the Democrats and probably Al Gore, the only thing they can win by winning legalistically is the presidency. Other than that, I think it'd probably be a real disaster for them if they manage to win it through a court challenge, because it just reminds people, again, why they don't like Al Gore in the first place, that he's someone who tends to rely on legal arcana to get through things.
All right. Let's get the professor's response to that.
Well, I think there's a lot to what the caller just said. I'm a little more reluctant probably to read a lot into what happened in the 19th century as predictive of what would apply here in terms of the split between the popular vote and the Electoral College. I think the circumstances are quite different and hard to draw too much from that. We kind of live in a time now where nominees and such do not just arise out of smoke-filled rooms, and smoke-filled rooms can be more predictable than what happens in primaries in 2004 or 2008. But I think there is a lot to what the caller just said about whoever wins this election, whether it is Al Gore or George W. Bush, is going to be in a very, very difficult position trying to govern this country. The Senate will be 50-50 or around that. The House is very narrowly split. If George W. Bush wins, which is most people expect, Tom Daschle has already given indications and other Democratic leaders of saying, look, you've got the presidency, you've got the House, you've got the Senate, this is your government, go lead it, you don't need us. And it's very hard to imagine whatever happens. A lot is going to go on legislatively with this government over the next 4 years. The ultimate test, of course, George W. Bush described himself as a uniter. Well, he's going to have his chance to prove that.
Now, the Bush campaign has looked at the Gore camp and has said, you know, we hope they reconsider their threats of lawsuits. They have, in practical terms, accused the Gore camp of, you know, wrangling with the presidential process just for hopes of winning. The Gore campaign has said that I believe the word used was presumptive, that they are beginning a presumptive transition and have crowned themselves the victors. How do you think both sides are handling this?
I think they're handling it as expected. Now, you know, that stops short of the normative judgment is what they're doing fair or right. But it's hard to imagine that if the titles were not flipped and if George Bush was the one on the outside of the technical count, but on the inside of the popular vote, he wouldn't be doing just the same exact thing as would Al Gore. I think that the cards really do sit in the Republican camp here because, as he's already beginning to do, George W. Bush will, the second this vote is at least temporarily certified, start appointing cabinet members, start the transition of government, set up his White House staff, and begin acting like a president-elect. We're already seeing that. And once that happens, the weight really does begin to fall on Al Gore's shoulders. Don't be a sore loser. You know, don't put the country through this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is why it's so hard to imagine George W. Bush not ultimately being the president of the United States, because there are so many cards that he holds. On the flip side, as I said at the beginning, it's a very, very difficult decision for Al Gore to turn to all of the people who are counting on him to keep pushing this forward, at least to some extent, to tell them, forget it, we're folding our tents and we're going home. And I think, listen to the callers. I mean, because in a way, it's going to be those who vote for Al Gore, they're the ones who are going to have to kind of be understanding about the notion that this man who may actually have taken the popular vote in Florida is going to concede the election. I mean, what are they going to say? Are they going to feel betrayed? The caller we just heard said he wouldn't. He almost thinks it's better for the nation. If that is the popular sentiment, then I think we know what will happen.
All right. That's Pat in Monticello. Pat?
Hello. This
Hi.
Is Pat. My question is about the 17,000 discarded votes And the idea that the election reflects the will of the people, and we're talking about 300 votes that George unofficially holds and 17,000 votes that were discarded. I saw the ballot on the TV, and I thought it was really confusing. And I'm just wondering how these 17,000 discarded votes would also reflect the will of the people in Florida.
Thanks, Pat.
Well, unfortunately, while it may seem unfair, just simply having a ballot that is confusing is probably never going to be enough to allow a judge to overturn what appears to be a popular vote. And I underline the words appears to be. And that's because if it was merely confusing, it's something that at least arguably either of the parties should have raised before the election. The ballot was apparently a public document. Now, that's different, isn't it, from whether the ballot is itself illegal. If the ballot is illegal, that is a whole different ball game. And again, there are two statutes that may be in question. One, which deals with ballots that are ballots in counties in which voting machines are not used. This appears, however, to be a situation in which the machines are used, as the professor just explained. And so from that standpoint, we look to Florida Statute Section 101.27. In that, there is a provision that says that the order in which the voting machine ballot is arranged shall as nearly as practical conform to the requirements of the form of the paper ballot for that election. Now, I'm not really sure what that means. That's for a judge to determine. If the ballot itself fails that test, then you might have the possibility of decertification. So I guess the answer to the caller, the long and the short of it is, confusion alone, while certainly troubling, and everything else is probably not going to cut it. Illegality is what the Gore people are going to need to prove.
You know, earlier you were talking about, along with the avenues of court challenges, the Bush campaign already acting as if they're putting a transition team together. They're leaking who they would name to a cabinet, and you were saying how that is going to increase pressure on Al Gore. But that's almost just a PR campaign, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it is a PR campaign.
You're making it sound like poker.
Well, there is a very, very high-level game of poker going on right now. You'll notice that Al Gore is not doing that. He's not meeting with his soon-to-be White House chief of staff. He's not playing that hand. Why not? Well, right now, according to the AP vote, he's still 327 votes behind. So there really is a sense that we can get away with more of this on the Bush side than Gore can get away with this on the Gore side. And so that's where the poker is. How far can Bush take it? I mean, you're asking some very, very critical questions. There's another side to all this, though. Bill Clinton was heavily criticized in 1992 for not doing a good enough job putting together a White House staff, that he spent so much time on the cabinet that he didn't really take care with the importance of his White House staff, and he suffered for it. If this continues to drag on into December, whoever is named president is going to have 5, 6, 7 weeks to put this thing together, and it's impossible to imagine him doing that. So he can stand up here and say, I'm going to assume some things because nothing's hurt. You know, no one's going to get it confirmed. But at the same time, I think you've hit it on the head. This is poker. And, again, I think that if we could sneak a look at the cards look better for a president-elect George W. Bush than for a president-elect Al Gore.
We are talking to David Yaloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut, where he studies and teaches constitutional law. We're talking to him about this historic and amazing presidential election. We'd like to know what you see in that presidential poker hand. 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're going to turn now to Stephen John. He's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.
Good morning, Catherine. President Clinton hosted three former presidents at a ceremony marking the 200th anniversary of the White House last night. Clinton told the gathering Americans should be proud of the close election. George Bush said no matter the outcome, He and his wife are proud of their son, George W. Bush. Of the living former presidents, only Ronald Reagan, afflicted with Alzheimer's disease, was unable to attend. Israel's killing yesterday of a Palestinian militia leader is bringing new violence today after the burial of the Palestinian. Gunmen opened fire on a Jewish holy site in Bethlehem, critically wounding an Israeli soldier. Israeli troops returned fire. Two Palestinians have died in today's gunfire. No economic news, not much earning news, and certainly no presidential election result. And as a result, the stock market doesn't have much reason to make any gains today. Prices have opened lower. Computer maker Dell is warning of slower revenue growth, and that's putting downward pressure on the tech stocks. In regional news, one state lawmaker is planning to introduce a bill that would make Minnesota the third state to give out its electoral college votes one by one. Minnesota currently employs a winner-take-all approach, but Representative Marty Seifert is drafting a bill to award one vote for each of eight congressional districts, with the two remaining votes going to the at-large winner. Governor Ventura's spokesman says he doesn't expect the indefinite leave of absence of Ventura's chief of staff to delay the state budget process in any way. Stephen Bosacker is taking some time to sort out the impact of being cited for indecent conduct in a Minneapolis health club. Mostly cloudy skies in the forecast today. There's a chance of light snow or flurries for the north with highs in the upper 20s to upper 30s. Maybe some light snow in the northwest tonight. Saturday could see some light snow moving in from the west with highs in the 30s. The Twin Cities expecting a high around 35 today. Mankato has 25 degrees this hour. It's 30 in St. Cloud. International Falls has 34 degrees, and it's 31 in the Twin Cities. That's a news update from Minnesota Public Radio.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Boston Scientific SciMed, based in Minnesota since 1971. 3,000 employees dedicated to creating innovative technologies to treat heart disease.
Hello, I'm Bill Kling, president of NPR. Over the years, you've told us we've become the best source of radio for adult audiences. We tell you about important issues. We do it with depth, balance, integrity, and accuracy. And many of you tell us that you learn from our broadcasts, that you stay tuned longer than planned, and that you make daily decisions from what you hear. When I started with NPR, there was no public radio. We built it, and we built it with the support of listeners. People trusted us, invested in us, and now you hear the result of that each day. We're proud of those of you who became early supporters. Together, we've created something so significant that it would be hard to imagine not having it. This has been a good year for many of you, and I hope you'll make it a priority to become a supporter of public radio during this year's membership drive. We need your support. We've got even more opportunities and challenges than ever. Consider the true value of NPR and become a member or increase your membership level this year. Thanks.
Programming is brought to you by the new and renewing members of Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks. I'm Catherine Lanfrey. You're listening to Mid-Morning. I want to remind you that we will be continuing our conversation on this week's historic and precedent-setting presidential election. In the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking to Darrell West. He's a professor of political science at Brown University, based in Rhode Island, of course. And we hope, of course, to keep talking to you. Meanwhile, we're continuing our conversation in this hour with David Yaloff. He's a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. If you'd like to join this conversation, it's 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Tom. He's calling us from St. Paul. Tom, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Hi.
I think that there's been entirely too much overreaction, and I think it's a combination of both the media and maybe some...
Tom, I got to stop you. Overreaction? We don't know who the president is.
Well, overreaction in this sense. This recount was not a result of Clinton challenging the vote, of Gore challenging the vote. It's mandated by state law, I believe.
Well, who said that Gore is doing that?
Well, I think that the perception, there's all these talk about what Gore is going to do, what will he do down the road, instead of allowing this part of the process, which was not driven by either party but was driven by law, to first take place and see what the results of that are. I know in this society we're not comfortable just letting things play themselves out, but I think both parties have handled it poorly in terms of what they've released and planning of transition teams. But as far as, thus far in the process, I don't think that Gore has done anything wrong in terms of wanting to wait until the results come in, because this is something that he didn't start this process. It was an automatic process. And I'm also curious as to whether the potential Bush call for recounts in other states, whether there's any actual mandate for a recount in those laws, or this would be tantamount to actually challenging the results, unlike in Florida, where it's not a result of a challenge, it's something that was mandated by law.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Well, in terms of the first point that the caller makes, I think you were absolutely correct until yesterday. Until yesterday, Al Gore and the Democratic officials had not tried to go beyond that automatic recount. And in that sense, they were in a very different position from Richard Nixon, who had to actually demand a recount in 1960 in Illinois and decided not to do it. Al Gore didn't have to make that difficult decision because it was automatic. And so from that standpoint, until yesterday, the caller was correct. But yesterday, a combination of comments from people who represent the Gore campaign, including Mr. Daley, gave the impression that Gore would back many of the legal challenges being played with in Florida courts about the harassment of voters, about the Palm Beach ballot, et cetera, et cetera. So it is fair, I think, to say that the Al Gore forces went beyond simply just waiting things out yesterday by indicating that they would be able to express some support for that. This reminds me of the second point that the caller made.
He was also talking about the fact now it looks like there are possible recounts in New Mexico,
that's right,
New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Iowa.
My impression is that there are not automatic recounts in those kinds of states. It's impossible to know whether there is bluster going on, whether George W. Bush is really trying to put a implicit threat in there that if you try to unravel Florida, we'll unravel some other states. And the truth is, Kevin, there's a lot riding on those other states. By simple math, even if George W. Bush loses Florida outright, if he's able to put together Oregon with 7 votes, where Gore only leads by 3,500, Wisconsin's 11 votes, where Gore only leads by 6,000, and New Mexico's 5 votes, where Gore only leads by 9,000. If he puts together those 23 votes, he's already at 269, which is one short of the majority. He can get it into the House, where a Republican would be in very good shape. The flip side of that is Al Gore doesn't need Florida. If he wins Oregon, where he's leading by 3,500, and he manages to overturn New Hampshire's 4 votes, where he leads where he lost by 7,000. So there is something to these other states, and that's, I think, part of the implicit threat that comes from George W. Bush's comments.
I want to intervene here,
sure,
and just point out that in Oregon, they're already talking about an automatic recount.
Absolutely.
There it would be automatic because
it's so close.
Oh, really?
Okay. Some states do automatic recounts based on the percentage of the overall total. Other states say if it's within X amount of votes, then the automatic recount. In Florida, I think it was a certain percentage, and they managed to be under that percentage, thus to trigger the automatic recount.
It sounds like what we're saying is this won't end with Florida.
Well, that's the hardest. That's the million-dollar question. I think that if all the absentee ballots come in and they really give George W. Bush the kind of lead which he had earlier in the week, and by all measures, apparently Bob Dole won the absentee ballots in Florida in 96 by a 54-40 margin despite losing the state. So you'd think those absentee ballots will go the Republican way. If that happens and Florida – and there's a sense that Florida really was won by George W. Bush, I think at that point it is going to be hard to imagine these other things playing out. It really is.
Now, we know that George W. Bush's campaign said today that the Florida vote recount confirms that he won. And they keep urging Al Gore to drop these challenges for the good of the country. I know that we've visited this point already this hour, but let's look at that again.
You know, what is good for the country? In 1960, I think it was very clear that Richard Nixon's move, deciding not to challenge Illinois, was for the good of the country. And that was for a simple reason. Even if Illinois had gone to Richard Nixon, he was at 300, Kennedy was at 303 electoral votes. Taking 26 away would have still left Kennedy above the 270. The other aspect of that is that Kennedy had won the popular vote by over 100,000 votes. And so you add that all up, there really was a sense of the inevitability of the Kennedy victory, and more importantly, the sense that the public had actually chosen John Kennedy. That is the question that remains here, the real sense that because Al Gore won the popular vote of the country, which apparently he will continue to do, and because there's a real question about whether George W. Bush won the popular vote in Florida, which is critical to that 270 number, you know, the comments that you hear is it's not good for the country to have somebody actually take office who a lot of people think did not win fair and square. And that's really what both of those candidacies, particularly Al Gore's, is wrestling with right now. Is it really doing what's best in the country for me to basically concede an election which so many people believe I may have won?
Now, I just want to go back to the Nixon thing very quickly, because I know that if you, for instance, go on Slate.com, and I think that other pundits have also looked at this, there's this perception that's being bandied about that Nixon graciously said, for the good of the country, I won't pursue this. But it was pursued. If you look at some history books, you'll discover that there were lots of investigations. I think there were even some charges that were later dropped. So I don't want to go too far into history. I just
No. You're right in the sense that, and by the way, that's going to be true in Florida, too. Even if Al Gore decided to, quote unquote, graciously concede, the lawsuits that are filed do not need Al Gore's permission. I mean, those lawsuits are citizen-based and can continue to be citizen-based. I think they lose a lot of the juice, if you will, if Al Gore says, I'm not with them. But that is true, and I think many of the lawsuits that were going on in Illinois and other states in 1960 continue to go on, and investigations continue to go on. But I think the key point there was that Richard Nixon actually met with John Kennedy. They had a conversation where they discussed the possibility, according to Richard Reeves, of there being some Republican appointees in a Democratic administration. And so I think there was a general sense that while Richard Nixon didn't discourage all the investigations that were going on, that this transition period would continue without his vocal objection. That's not where we are right now in this particular race.
Let's go to Barbara in St. Louis Park.
Good morning. I had a question regarding the splitting of the electoral votes within a state. Someone mentioned to me yesterday that I think it's Maine might have some kind of provision whereby they can divide the number of electoral votes. And is there any possibility of doing that in Florida, dividing them proportionate to the popular vote?
The answer is that anything is possible. There's actually two states that do that kind of split, Maine and Nebraska, where they award each of the candidates one electoral vote if they win the congressional district, and then they award the individual who wins the state as a whole the two votes indicative of the Senate. And in Maine, there was some question in 1992 whether Ross Perot might have snuck one of those electoral votes away. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, you're absolutely correct. And the Florida law that I mentioned earlier does give the state legislature the power to appoint electors if they're not appointed on election day. There's no telling what they could do with that particular provision. They could, for example, decide we think Al Gore actually won this thing and divide it 13 for Al Gore, 12 for George W. Bush. They could say we'll go 12-12 and leave one undecided or one uncommitted. Absolutely correct, the caller's point. That does ride with the legislature. But the important point to make here is that there's another provision of Florida law which makes conclusive any determination of a voting controversy settled by means that the legislator had enacted prior to Election Day. In this case, there's a vote, there's a recount, and a challenge. And so can the state legislature boldly go where no state legislature has gone recently? That's another question that remains undecided.
Let's go to David calling us from Des Moines, Iowa.
Hi, I was wondering, what do you think? It seems like both parties are really setting us up for a major gridlock here. I mean, I've noticed that it seems like on the Republican side they used Daley's name quite a bit with the example of the butterfly ballot yesterday. I think it was to try and invoke the past Nixon thing and the dead people voting.
David, and what's your question?
And also on the other side that protesters are claiming to be bushwhacked. But I'm wondering if this does start into a whole bunch of legal episodes, not just in Florida but in other states, if Republicans move up, if that will bring a rise of the third party power, because currently no one's blaming Nader for the loss of Florida anymore. It seems like it's all the ballot issue.
All right. Thanks, David.
Well, I'm not sure if I agree with you that Nader has gotten off the hook in the minds of many Democratic voters and Democratic officials. A lot of these states were very close calls, including some that went to George W. Bush, like New Hampshire, and Ralph Nader's effect on that is impossible to determine. But I guess I wouldn't agree with the caller that Ralph Nader has gotten off scot-free. I think there's a real sense that in an election as close as this, that if Ralph Nader had not been a formidable part of it, we would be talking right now about President-elect Al Gore. In terms of whether all of this could lead to a third-party challenge, I guess I don't see that either. I think that one of the lessons that came out of this was that in the end, 97% of the votes in this country went to one of the two parties, despite the fact that Ralph Nader ran a highly visible campaign, at least at the end, and that Pat Buchanan had run on the ticket of a party that had earned 20% of the vote in 1992. At times of peace and prosperity, it's very tough for third parties to break through. And I have trouble seeing how all of this is going to play into the third party's hands unless you get the kind of gridlock over the next 4 years that frustrates people for a lot of different reasons.
We're going to go to Margaret in Hopkins. Margaret, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you for having me, Catherine. I have a question today, and that is with regard to the potential idea of a revote in Florida. I'd like to comment that if a revote were to occur, it would be unfair to someone like myself because I went into the election not knowing anything about the outcome, and everybody who would be revoting would know something that I didn't know, and I think that is democratically unfair.
What do you mean?
Well, they would know the outcome, and they're going into...
How do you think they would know the outcome?
They know the outcome as it stands. Excuse me. They know the outcome as it stands today. So they have the potential to change their vote.
Okay.
Who's going to call them? I mean, who's going to know?
Okay. Thank you.
So that makes it somewhat unfair, to those of us who didn't know anything at all. And also, with all these claims about ballot confusion, what I think is critical for people to understand is that, pretty soon we're going to open the floodgates to people saying, "Well, I didn't take my medication this morning, and therefore my head wasn't clear, and I didn't, I didn't make the right decision, or I couldn't read the ballot because I didn't have my right glasses on." Or I think this is very dangerous, and I think I would really ask you to please address this question.
All right.
Well, I think the second point you made is very well taken. Confusion. It was unclear. It wasn't as clear as it should be. These are just not going to be nearly enough for a local judge in Florida to overturn or decertify an election. It's just never going to happen like that. The critical argument that they're going to have to make is not confusion. It's going to have to be it's an illegal ballot.
Well, aren't people also right now, at least on the Republican side and I think elsewhere, making the point that at some point individual responsibility enters into the picture? I mean, surely most Americans know you can't vote twice on one ballot.
Absolutely. I guess it's, where I vote in Connecticut, you can change your mind 100 times about how you vote before you actually pull that lever. The kind of ballots we're talking about here, once you actually push something through, you can't reverse it in any kind of way, shape, or form. And, you're right, but if these laws were created for a reason, and that is to make sure that whatever votes take place are going to be votes that are based largely on the votes that the voters intended to issue, it is not going to be an easy thing, Catherine, for a local county judge to ignore blatant violations of the law in the way it was set up. Again, I side with the first guess that you had. It is very hard for me to imagine a local county judge overturning or even decertifying a legitimate election. The pressure is going to be so enormous on any kind of judge in that situation to stay out, and it's hard to imagine somebody overcoming that. But the caller's first point about the revote, I think, includes some other...
I'm going to stop you for a minute. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine that in Florida, where we had the Elian Gonzalez case, in Florida, where we've had a Miami mayoral election overturned. I mean, work with me here.
Well, I'll try to work with you, but you're right. Florida is a wacky place in many ways. Before a local county judge has that authority, this is going to at least go up to the Florida Supreme Court, and there's a very good chance that if it ties into issues of constitutional or federal law, which is unclear yet, the U.S. Supreme Court may look at it too. A local county judge is going to have a lot more power over where an individual like Ilian Gonzalez can be held,
mm-hmm.
and especially over where a mayoral race may end up, than when you're talking about issues about electors that will serve in an electoral college that will determine the president of the United States. I think it is a different form of pressure, although I think your skepticism is in some ways well placed.
All right, now let's get back to Margaret's first point, that she feels that as someone who voted in another state, if there was a revote, the electorate there would have an advantage that would be undemocratic.
Well, I don't really necessarily agree with the point that it's going to change how individuals vote based on what they now know. It strikes me that those who wanted to vote for Al Gore will still vote for Al Gore, albeit more carefully, and those who vote for George W. Bush will vote for him as well. I'm more interested in issues of turnout. I mean, the turnout was amazing in Florida, but it was not 100%. If it becomes clear that this revote, if you can imagine such a thing, will actually determine the President of the United States, I'm expecting 99% turnout. And what does that extra 17% do is a very large question mark. The issues that surround a revote are just so overwhelming. Are you going to have both of the candidates go down and campaign some more? Is there going to be a special Palm Beach debate? I mean, these are. I mean,
but are just, we are we going to have a revote? I mean, how likely is that?
It is almost impossible. I mean, a revote gets you into so many difficult circumstances. I think if every single thing breaks Al Gore's way, it's going to be a decertified election. And
I'm
going to
stop
be,
you. I'm going to stop you right
sure.
there. If everything breaks Gore's way, it's a decertified election. What do we mean by that phrase?
Well, what we mean is that at least one judge has determined that because of voter irregularities, illegalities of violations of Florida law and other possible discrepancies, that the outcome of the actual vote, whether it's in Palm Beach or in a larger area, cannot be trusted, that the outcome itself is in serious doubt. At that point, a local county judge would have the legal right to refuse to and deny and enjoin any possible certification of those results such that the state legislature can forward it on to the Electoral College.
And so what happens then?
Well, now we're getting into more questions. A lot of people think, well, at that point you have two candidates, neither of whom have an Electoral College majority, and then it goes into the House.
Well, I'm gonna stop you one more time, because, boy, you can get so arcane and wrapped up in these things. The likelihood that someone is going to – that so many irregularities exist that a judge will decertify, you think is slim.
Oh, my God, yes. Absolutely. Very slim. The pressure is going to be overwhelming for this local county judge, even in the face of irregularities, to say that while there are some questions and while he or she will concede some questions, that they're not willing to then cross the threshold and say that the outcome of the entire election is in doubt. But maybe that's why the recount that's going on right now by hand and by machine is so critical. If those numbers stay below 300, below 200, maybe that's where a local county judge will get the chutzpah, if you will. And if the numbers go back up to 1,700, which is where they were before the recount, where some people think it still is, and where absentee ballots might bring it back to, well, then it's even more impossible to imagine.
But even if the count stayed at 327, which is the unofficial tally from the Associated Press, that doesn't mean it's irregular. It simply means it's close.
No, absolutely. That's where these legal challenges come in. That's where these lawsuits about Florida Statute 101.27, about the 19,000 ballots that were thrown out, that's where all that comes in. And as your previous guest made the point, if you go hand count on ballots, there may be a way to determine that some of these calls on ballots that were thrown out because two punches were actually found are actually not two punches found, because you have that hanging part of the ballot, I think were his words, and I think that's correct.
The hanging chad.
The hanging chad. All these new words entering our...
I know, butterfly ballot. Who thought that would be on everyone's tongue a few days
no,
ago?
No, I think we're going to leave this to those who study the insect world.
We're going to go to Jeff in St. Louis Park. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Real briefly, I don't think the judge would have any if those ballots were in fact illegal, and it seems like they are in two basic ways, I don't think the judge would have any problem discrediting the vote count and calling for a new vote. But if it was a question, and I haven't heard anyone ask this, if it still was a question in the judge's mind, why don't we look at the 19,000 discarded votes? And if a large majority of those were punched for both Gore and Buchanan, that would give the judge more weight to decide that the election was not fair and to call for a new election.
Well, again, I think the point's already been made. The fact that two of the individuals were both punched in does not necessarily on its face render the ballot unfair, although it does look very confusing and not an easy ballot to fill out. Again, those are issues that some would argue should have been taken up before the election, not afterwards. The one thing I think I will take a little bit of objection to is the notion that it's very simple and clear that these ballots violate Florida law. I think it's very unclear, and I think a judge is going to have to wrestle with that, because these are voting machine ballots, and the law that applies to voting machine ballots does not require that the punch-out area be on the right of the names, which that is only a requirement for those ballots that are in counties to which voting machines are not used. The only issue that this judge is going to have to deal with is whether the order that the ballot is arranged in is practicable and conforms to the requirements in that way. Part of it forces them to be conforming to the requirements of a paper ballot for the election, but again, as nearly as practicable. And so that's going to be, those four words, as nearly as practicable, is going to have to be something that that county judge deals with, and I do not think it's clear at all.
Let's go quickly to Dan in Decorah, Iowa. Dan, can you be quick?
Yes, I can be. I'm just resenting the fact that the notion is being put out that this delay in the result is it's kind of like we're a banana republic country and we have to get this resolved. If the professor,
so your point, Dan.
My point is that if we need to recount everything in Florida by hand and we need to recount the other states, we should take the time to do the job right. And
all right, Dan, I thank you for that. Professor Yaloff, we're down to seconds. Do you want to leave us with a political benediction?
Oh, I wish I had some. I think, you know, in other countries, they're watching this with tremendous interest. And I think, you know, what they forget is that Americans, while they treat their politics like sport, often have a quiet complacency about the ability of the system to work itself out in the end. And I think you're seeing that complacency so far. I hope it holds.
All right. David Yaloff, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Okay. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. David Yaloff is a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. Want to remind you that earlier in the hour, we also spoke to Mike Macinter. He's a professor of law at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And, of course, we want to remind you that we will be continuing this conversation on this historic presidential election. We'll still be taking your calls and your comments here on Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Care 11, host of care11.com, 24-hour access to updated weather, radar, news, and traffic information, care11.com.